This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of March 5th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. If a consumer financial protection agency falters in Congress and no one is around to protest, does it matter? This week, the rumblings in Washington grew ever stronger that there will not be a new independent agency to police the selling of bad mortgages, unfair credit card terms, and the like. The idea has been near death and resurrected several times since President Barack Obama proposed it last spring. But aggressive lobbying from the banking industry may well win out over consumer sentiment. But do people care? We decided to take the pulse of consumers in Washington, New York, and Portland to find out if they even want this protection.
If they did their job, it would be a great idea. Unfortunately, we just keep adding agencies that don't make anything work. So then we pay for it with our taxes.
So two sides to it.
Yeah. I wouldn't be upset at all if it didn't go through.
Not too happy with the current the route that they're trying to take and trying to basically create a bigger government.
So the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, you're against that?
Yeah, I think people need to just be a little bit more responsible with how they spend their money.
Honestly, I haven't heard of that part yet, and it would be nice. You know, consumers need to be protected because there's a lot of people out there who are vulnerable and don't know what's going on, and they're not informed, or they're just oblivious to the whole situation, maybe don't care.
I think a lot of times the banks and stuff, they take advantage of the consumers, and we don't really know what's going on, and they change stuff on us all the time. So I think someone looking out for us would be a good idea.
Would you be disappointed if it didn't happen?
I think I would, yeah. I would.
Well, I haven't heard that much about it, but I know that they have been talking about protecting the consumers against predatory lending and things of that nature. And I think that they do need to have some type of protection for the, you know, for the average consumer. Where they place it, who's going to oversee it, all like that. I just trust that the leadership that's in position right now will make the right decisions based upon that.
I would like to think that with the way the economy is going, that the American public would want to encourage Congress and that Congress would want to, you know, help out the American public by doing this. But at the same time, the fact that it's even a controversial thing sort of makes me feel a little pessimistic about it. And I think even if it did get enacted, there would be the same general forces of the financial industry trying to sort of weaken any consumer protections that would be out there. So I'm a little bit pessimistic, I guess.
The voices of Natalie Strater, CJ Shantas, Samantha Hoy, Alice Hall, Kevin Laws, and Jenny Lohr, speaking with us this week from the streets of New York City, Washington, D.C., and Portland, Oregon. This week, President Obama traveled to Savannah, Georgia, to make the case for his HomeStar initiative. Homeowners would get up to $3,000 worth of rebates for improvements like insulation and windows. That could make a serious dent in the bill for home efficiency projects, but they can still be expensive. So what to do? Well, this week, San Francisco joined a growing list of cities with something called a PACE program, Property Assessed Clean Energy. And it's supposed to make green upgrades available to anyone who wants them. Ted Flanagan was with the energy consulting firm EcoMotion. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Describe for us how the PACE program works. Give us a rundown of the basics.
Sure. It's really quite a revolutionary program for the world of energy efficiency and renewable energy. They're technically a lien on the property. And that's quite interesting because unlike borrowing money from a bank, mm-hmm. now you're borrowing it from your city or your county and your payments are on your property tax. A big advantage of this is that if you're thinking about putting a solar system on your house, but you're sort of scratching your head thinking, well, I may be moving in 3 or 4 years.
Right.
This assessment now or this lien on your property is actually transferred on to the next owner of
the property. It stays with the property.
It stays with the property. And that's a really key distinction. So the individual's credit is not important. Most of these programs are being set up so even your amount of equity in your house is not important.
Hmm.
It's just that you have clear title to the property and you're current in your property tax payments.
And obviously the reason this is attractive for folks is because, you know, if you're like me and you would love to put solar panels on your house, but you look at the cost and say, no way.
Right.
This is a way that maybe you can do
it. It's really true. It's been the first cost has been the big barrier to efficiency upgrades and certainly solar systems.
Yeah.
Our house, live in Glendale, and we were looking at a solar system. We want to offset about 90% of our consumption, about a $25,000 solar system.
Woo.
Net cost after generous rebates from the local utility and tax credits, net cost of about $11,000. But still, where do you come up with that cash?
Right.
You do have a range of options. If you happen to have money in the bank, that's one option. Most of us don't.
Which, of course, we encourage here at Marketplace Money.
Save your money. And you could also use your credit card, but that has very high interest rates. So
right.
So this new form of financing is sort of in the middle. It might not be as good as if you're refinancing your home right now, which you could roll your solar system into.
Mm-hmm.
Might not be as good as a home equity line if you have good credit. But it does afford many people a reasonably priced means of getting into the game.
Now, what is eligible for the PACE program? We've been talking a lot about solar panels, but what about things like energy efficient refrigerators and dishwashers or, I don't know, trees to block the sun from your house? I mean, are those kinds of things eligible as well?
Yeah, good question. The law here in California is written that eligible technologies include energy efficiency fixtures and renewable energy systems. By the term fixture, that means that it has got to be affixed to the property.
Hmm.
Things like insulation are affixed. They're not coming out when you move.
Right.
Things that are really hardwired in a solar system. Not eligible are things like light bulbs or refrigerators and dishwashers that you mentioned.
Okay. Now, what about the energy efficiency tax breaks that are out there right now, both at the federal level and a lot of states have these, even local municipalities? Can you combine those tax breaks with using a PACE program to spread out those payments?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Here's this mountain of cost that's mm-hmm. your solar system on your house. What are you going to do? Oh, my gosh.
Right.
I've heard that my utility gives me a slice of that cost back in the form of a rebate. I know I get a tax credit. All those are ways of reducing this mountain of cost. And the way these PACE programs are set up, you can either finance, in some jurisdictions, you can finance 100% of that mountain. And in other cases, you can just finance the net cost after local incentives and tax credits.
Ted Flanagan is president of EcoMotion, a consultancy firm that offers services to help cities develop their solar strategies. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've reported before on some of the ways folks are supporting themselves while they're looking for work. Today, we feature a story of creativity mixed with not a little desperation. From San Francisco, Heidi Pickman profiles someone close to her who's used to living on the edge.
My friend Kat Bate will do almost anything to earn a buck in this economy. One recent Monday night, she picked up a bed.
Yeah, I think the mattress is a little big, so it'll have to hang over a little bit.
The bed didn't fit in the client's new apartment in San Francisco. He offered $125 on Craigslist to move it to his mother's house in Las Vegas. Kat was headed to Vegas anyway, if she could round up some cash. Out of 15 responses, she got the gig. Kat is 42 years old. I've witnessed more than 3 years of her unemployment spell. After a personal tragedy, she sold everything and left her customer service job at a jewelry manufacturer after 10 years.
I went to wandering for a little while, and when I came back, it was just the wrong time to re-enter civilization.
Yeah, like trying to find a job at the beginning of a major recession. For now, Kat's doing what she's done on and off for 20 years.
I will street vend until I find a job.
She's earned a decent living selling crafts at street fairs like this one in Berkeley. And she's traveled cross-country to work music festivals like Lollapalooza in Bonnaroo. She's traded hair wraps for wrapping hula hoops and colorful tape. It takes her 15 minutes to make a hoop. They sell for $25 and up.
I did not mean it to turn into a money-making enterprise full-time, but it's actually paid my rent over the summer, so.
A year and a half ago, at big concerts, Kat would net an average of $700 a day. This year, she averaged about $200. After paying vendor fees, some days she was lucky to break even. Kat tells me that she really does want a job with benefits, but finding a regular stream of income has been tough. For every available job, six people want it, even entry-level positions. Kirill Elestrada works for Rubicon Programs, a job placement organization. He says professionals are squeezing out those with fewer credentials, like Kat, who doesn't have a college degree.
Places like movie theaters and customer service and working in cafes, coffee shops, you know, there's much more competition, and the people who are more experienced are willing to take those positions.
Last year, I helped Kat revamp a resume. She applied to over 100 job openings, warehouse work, taxi companies, waitressing, and of course, customer service jobs. Nada. She can't even get a minimum wage job at a convenience store.
My economic situation is in the toilet. I am literally living hand to mouth.
She had to get creative.
In life, my experience has taught me how to hustle up, you know, small gigs and random odd jobs.
She stood on corners counting foot traffic. That paid $20 an hour. She's bartended at the occasional party. About once a month, Kat does product demos for beauty care products. And she's participated in market research studies, which often pay $75 an hour. One time, she had a bunch of wires attached to her head with gel.
I felt like a Borg. And they would have you watch a screen and respond by pressing a button. I believe they were testing, you know, subliminal messages.
Kat's seen the headlines that the economy is on the upswing. But until the good times become more than a number on a page, people like her will keep cobbling together small jobs to get by, even if it means hauling a bed to Vegas.
Okay.
Here's a portion of cash. My mom will give you the rest.
Okay.
In San Francisco, I'm Heidi Pickman for Marketplace Money.
Sure, education is important, but should you shell out for school or worry about your own future?
Having your kids in a private school from the get-go, you're asking for trouble. If you have limited means, you're basically playing chicken with your retirement now.
That plus more of your wallet dramas. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Each week, we rifle through our inbox and scan our voicemails to find a few questions to take from you. And here to assist me in providing some answers is David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Now, before we get started with some listener calls, I wanted to take you back in time.
Ooh. That was my sound effect for that.
Very nice.
Thank you.
For the last segment that you did on the show here a few weeks ago, remember that letter that a listener got that looked like a job offer from Texaco?
That was a good one.
It was a good one. So she got this this thing in her email, and it said, "We're interested in you," and you said that this is happening to folks who are posting on job boards. Well, Daryl Haynes wrote in after hearing that segment. He was an officer with the Wichita Police Department for 35 years, and he retired last year. He called us up, and he said that there's actually something even more nefarious going on here than we knew. So we called him up and asked him to tell us about it.
They are recruiting people for jobs, but the jobs really entail people taking money that is put into their account by the bad guys, taking that money out of the account, taking it out of the banking system, taking it down to Western Union, and then sending that money to the Czech Republic or to the Ukraine or various other Eastern Bloc areas from where it's never seen again.
And you called this a money mule scam.
Correct.
Kind of like a drug mule, only it's money.
Right. You're taking the money from here and sending it there. And so they're using the U.S. citizen to transfer the money when they would have difficulty getting that money to the faraway places themselves. Like I say, most of these folks, they're unwitting, and then they get caught up in this. Their bank account's frozen. They're liable for some of the money because they've taken the money, they've taken it out of the banking system, and it was fraudulently obtained money.
So, David, our fear was that if the listener had clicked on a link in that letter, she'd be eventually asked for her Social Security number and, you know, it would go downhill from there. But this sounds like it's actually even more complex and scary.
I don't put it past the scammers. They're bringing their A game to this recession.
They certainly are. Let's go to the phones. First, we have Ruth in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And I understand that you are one of the people I envy. You live out in the country on a farm.
We do. And the city isn't too far away, so it's, you know, pretty ideal.
What do you think of all this talk of urban farming? You know, people keeping chickens in the backyard of their apartments, stuff like that. You know, farming is, I don't know, David, almost recession chic these days, isn't it?
You say that like it's a bad thing. I'm going to go home and feed my chickens. I mean, it's like a slur.
So what does someone who owns a real farm think of all that?
I think it's great. I mean, if there's land, put it to use. You know,
yeah.
During World War II, didn't they have victory gardens? And so I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, tell it to the neighbor, the guy with the rooster next door. That's what I say.
Yeah, that is a bit of a problem.
Thank you.
You don't have that problem, though, right?
No, we don't.
Do you raise animals, food on your farm, or is this more of a just having some lovely property?
Well, it's some lovely property that was inherited from the family. We do, you know, raise farm food, and mostly for us, but we're looking at maybe, you know, doing more than that, and we have some animals, and so it's been sort of a family business, but we're looking at expanding it more because there is such an interest in local grown food.
Right, right. Maybe you could head over to the farmer's market. Sell there.
Well, I'll tell you, Ruth, when my whole newspaper gig falls apart, maybe you're going to need a hand at the farm, so you keep me in mind. That sounds great.
David's on the next flight. Now, I understand that you, though, have a question not about farming, thank goodness, because we couldn't answer it.
Farm talk.
Farm talk, yeah. But about school.
I do. It's a question about when is it best to invest in education. We happen to live in an area where there's some good independent schools, and our kids are at one now, and we love the education they get. But, you know, it's a financial stretch, and we don't really have any money that's left to put into savings toward college.
Hmm.
I mean, my gut tells me I'm giving them a good foundation, and we'll figure out the rest later. But, you know, I also have this hidden fear of when they get to be college age, what do we do?
Without getting into the whole public versus private school debate, which could go on forever and ever, is there a reason that you put your kids in private school where you are?
Well, I think it's a really quality education. You know, the ratio of teachers to student is lower. They don't teach to the test.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm a product of a public school education, and I did okay, I think. But I think it's really good to prepare your kids as well as you can.
Well, David, would you like to become our education expert? Is it more important to have the best education early on or saving for later in college?
You know, what's really interesting here is that Ruth and I are in virtually the same position because I've got my third grader in a bodacious public school. In fact, we picked the neighborhood for the school, but the middle school that it feeds into, not so good. And the public high school after that, also not so good for the back end. I mean, Ruth, I feel your pain. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So what have you decided?
Well, there's some tricky questions here. And one thing, Ruth, that you didn't bring into this is what about your own retirement planning? How have you factored that into the equation?
Well, we don't really have a plan. I mean, there's not much money left to put away. You
exactly.
Know?
Oh.
And that's what we're looking at, my wife and I, in looking at the same thing of how do we prioritize our limited resources. Here's how I'm dealing with it, Ruth, and that is I'm going to try and extend the public education at the front end for as long as I possibly can. Public school at the elementary or middle school level is going to do less damage, if you will, than public school at the high school level where a lot of formative stuff is going on. At least that's how I'm looking at the landscape. I would think, though, that having your kids in a private school from the get-go, you're asking for trouble. If you have limited means, you're basically playing chicken with your retirement now, and that's not a good place to be.
And Ruth, you know, I think at least here on Marketplace Money, we really do believe that you've got to pay yourself first. There are ways to pay for college that they can contribute to. They cannot contribute to your retirement.
Yeah.
And they won't if you ask them.
And they won't.
So there's that. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, sure, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, exactly. I'll get back to you, Dad. Right? That's not going to happen. But Tess is exactly right. You've got to let the kids carry a little bit of this water, not because you're trying to do some tough love and not because you're trying to teach them some kind of lesson, but simply because that's how you're going to have to do it. The whole family is going to be pulling their weight to some extent, and you got to maintain some focus on your retirement planning. Otherwise, you will be out on the cold on the farm, and the chickens are going to be running everything. It's going to be like Animal Farm out there. You don't want that.
Good advice.
So I really think that what we're saying here is you really got to start planning for your retirement. But have we answered the question of early education versus college? Or is that even an option? If you start funding your retirement plan, will you be sending the kids now to public school?
Well, it is kind of – that's the choice, really. Yeah. Or maybe we just get another job, another income source. Maybe those vegetables will bring in some money.
There you go. Farmers markets.
But don't forget to set aside that money for when I come out and work as a farmhand, because that's
okay.
part of my retirement plan.
You're not going
to
work for free?
Like here?
All right. Thanks, Ruth.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, and next up we have Bill in Memphis, Tennessee. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I understand that you are in school.
I am. I'm a PhD candidate at a university.
Wow, what are you studying?
Chemistry.
How does one get interested in chemistry? Did you have a set as a kid and you thought, this is really cool?
I didn't. I did make models, model cars, and have always been interested in the way that things are put together and sort of extrapolated that down to the molecular level.
Admit it, Bill. One day you put a Mentos into the Diet Coke and you said, by God, I can build a career off of this.
Actually, I did teach high school chemistry for a year and enjoyed showing my students how to do things like that.
Uh-huh. All right. So from what I understand, we have a bit of a housing question here. What's the market like there in Memphis?
We have seen a lot of foreclosures here.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, that's created sort of an opportunity to pick up these foreclosures and turn them around.
Ah. Do you already own your own home?
I do.
Okay. So you're looking to pick up a foreclosure for what? Renting it out or?
Maybe as a short-term investment, but most likely to do renovations and then try and turn it around in the next few months.
You're going
to
be flipping the property, in other words.
That's right.
We're back to flipping homes already?
Yes, we are.
Oh, no.
Part of the beauty of being in a down Memphis market is that it's pretty easy to pick up a house at a foreclosure here for $40,000.
So we're not talking about like the California market, for example, where a foreclosed property
half a million
is still,
dollars.
Yeah, exactly. And it's being presented as a fire sale.
Actually, I'm looking to go into this investment with a few other friends. And between the four of us, then we can pay cash for it.
Now, when you say go in on the investment, do you mean that they would help you after you bought the house?
We would be splitting the purchase. Then we have a lot of home renovating experience ourselves.
So you would be going in on a home with a bunch of buddies.
That's right. There's actually a specific property that we're looking at, and it will cost us about $40,000. We expect that it has $6,000 to $7,000 in renovations that need to be done.
That doesn't sound like much.
No, it's not much. It's actually in pretty good shape. The original owners stripped out all of the hardware and things like that, even down to the air registers. But most of what it needs are just floors to be redone and repainting and just normal work. But we have talked to a local realtor about it who has said that in this neighborhood, houses priced less than $95,000. So 85 to 95 are selling just fine in 30 to 60 days. But it looks like based on the numbers, this house could move.
It's kind of a small business they're describing now. I mean, flipping properties is not a game for the faint of heart, nor is the foreclosure market for that matter. But one thing that kind of intrigues me here is the fact that Bill and his buddies are handy, meaning that they're going to keep their overhead on this process relatively low. I know a number of contractors, for example, who play this game. And, you know, they come out ahead oftentimes because it's the sweat of their brow that's bridging them from the purchase of the property to the sale of the property, assuming there will be a sale of the property.
We're in a position to hang on to it for a little while and even rent it out if we need to.
But it sounds like you're buying for $40,000 and you're looking at selling for around $90,000, $95,000. You're not making a huge profit. Is it worth all that effort?
Well, we're doubling the investment.
Yeah.
So it all depends on how fast you can do the work and get out of it.
Right.
Sure. Sure.
And do you know these guys well enough? Are you buddies enough that you know they're going to follow through with all this?
These are some really close friends, and we've undertaken a couple of adventures in the past.
Oh?
We did actually invest together, buy a boat, renovate the boat, and then take the boat down the Mississippi River from Memphis to New Orleans.
Ooh, that must have been fun.
These guys are living a reality TV show.
Yes, certainly.
I want a piece of this action.
Flip your house, flip your boat.
Well, we like to keep things interesting.
Did you sell the boat?
We did. We sold the boat after we got back from the trip.
So you have already flipped a boat. I don't know. Does that qualify them to be house flippers?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm very impressed by their moxie. And you know, there's every reason to think these guys can pull it off. The main things you guys have to keep in mind is the real estate market might not cooperate. Your worst case scenario is you're stuck with this thing. Your semi worst case scenario is you're renting it out. And your best case scenario is you're turning it around at a profit. As long as you guys can stomach all of those various scenarios, I say, what the heck?
Well, good, good. I'm glad to hear that. You know, I listen to the show every week, and it's really nice to hear somebody say, just go for it every once in a while.
Okay, thanks for the call. Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you. Thanks.
David, I think this is one where we're going to want to check in a few months and see if they actually did this project.
Absolutely, and whether they came out ahead or not.
And whether they came out ahead or not, whether they were actually able to sell the house.
Yeah.
Well, if you and your friends have a harebrained or not so harebrained idea that you want to run by us, do give us a call. Our money line is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can write to us, find a Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, are you a fan of Friday Night Lights?
Help me here.
This was a plot line in Friday Night Lights.
That's like a football show, right?
It is a football show.
See, I'm not completely out of touch.
But it's not about football.
It's about something, hometown values or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
Hometown Texas values.
Like Melrose Place, but with pigskin. No, okay. He doesn't get it. Okay.
Never mind. We'll move on from here, and we'll be back later in the show to talk more about money with David Lazarus, including whether a promotion from your bank could hurt your local grocery store.
Marketplace Money is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local Trusted Choice agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE or online at trustedchoice.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, we are back with more of your questions. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times is with me, and Karen is on the phone from Seattle, Washington. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And you?
I'm good.
Now, the background I have on you here says you like to cook. So when will you be coming down to make lunch for the Marketplace Money staff?
Actually, we're coming down there in the fall.
You are? What's the best meal that you've made recently?
I made a souffle the other night.
You made a souffle?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm impressed.
Okay.
That's one thing I have not been willing to try to tackle myself. How about you, David?
I get pancakes when I make souffles.
Nice.
Well, and I guess perhaps relatedly, your question is about the grocery store.
It is. I recently got a flyer in the mail from our bank, Wells Fargo, about a 2010 Visa consumer grocery promotion they're doing. And basically, they're asking their customers for the month of March to use their debit card as credit cards when they purchase groceries. And they'll give you 2% back up to $5 for the whole period.
$5?
That's it. Yeah. And to me, it's sort of a scam because they're trying to get you to use your debit cards as credit cards so they can charge the retailers credit card fees.
Sort of a scam? Let's not qualify it.
So I actually called Wells Fargo to complain, and the person I talked to said, no, you're completely wrong. It's the only way we can offer our PIN-based transaction customers in a rewards program. And I think it's horrible, and I just wanted people to be aware about it. It's like the big banks don't get how mad the consumers are about the credit card fees.
And frankly, not only are they not getting it, they don't care. Mm-hmm.
These guys have proven themselves utterly tone deaf. Mm-hmm.
David, this has become a real thing over the last year or so. But the catch here is that costs the merchant money.
That's money that the merchant will be passing along to, right, to his or her,
exactly,
customer. Something to keep in mind there as well. I don't want to sound like these guys are just a bunch of rapacious Cossacks.
No.
But these guys are just a bunch of rapacious Cossacks, and you want to be very mindful of that.
I wonder, did you ask the grocery store about this?
You know, I did. I shop at an independent grocer, so I called and talked to him to find out, you know, what the difference is for him. And he, mm-hmm, said because of his confidentiality with the agreements he has with Visa and MasterCard, he's not able to tell me.
Wow.
But, you know, he appreciated my informing him about it, and he said he was going to ask his checkers to start asking people.
It's a very secretive and shadowy world and completely unjustified.
So I guess really, if you want to help yourself, if you want to help the merchant and not help the credit card company, the debit card company, use your PIN.
Exactly.
Good question, Karen.
Okay, thanks.
Well, if you've got a beef with your bank or, you know, just maybe you want to rave about your bank.
Oh, we'll get a lot of those calls.
I'm sure we will. You can tell us about it on our money line. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. David, thanks for making our problems your problems.
Well, this is way too much fun.
It is fun, isn't it?
It is.
Well, something that's often not so fun is your taxes. We want your calls and emails and questions about those 1099s, W-2s, rebates, and refunds. We'll tackle a few of them on our next show. So write in. And remember to check with a professional before you make any big money decisions. Lots of companies claim their products are time machines that can make you look younger. And the more money they charge, the more you might believe them.
The anti-aging formulas that you see in fancy department stores are no better than anything you'd pay $15 for in a drugstore.
Hear how the real keys to youth don't cost a dime. Coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We talked earlier in the show about some of the creative ways by which one woman is dealing with unemployment. Well, here's another option. Join the Peace Corps. You may think to yourself, isn't that just for the youngins? Nope. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
President Kennedy focused on college students when he started the Peace Corps. He made one of his first appeals for service in October of 1960 at the University of Michigan.
How many of you who are going to be doctors are willing to spend your days in Ghana? How many of you are willing to work in the Foreign Service and spend your lives traveling around the world?
Terry Garland Bollinger was in first grade when she first heard Kennedy's call to serve, but she didn't get around to answering it until she was in her 50s. Garland Bollinger spent just over 2 years with the Peace Corps in Ukraine. She came back to the U.S. last year.
I just think it's really important to try to give back to life. Life has been very generous and good to me.
Garland Bollinger left her job as a chief financial officer for a nonprofit to join the Peace Corps. In Ukraine, she was called a community development business educator. She ran English language programs on workforce development. She worked with the medical college on HIV awareness. She taught English in Ukrainian elementary schools. Oh, and she taught international finance full-time at a Ukrainian university. In the U.S., Garland Bollinger's time wouldn't come cheap. She has a master's in finance and years of corporate experience. How do recent college grads compete with that on their Peace Corps applications? They don't. Rosie Mock is the Peace Corps' Associate Director for Volunteer Recruitment.
If we had a young person and somebody with more experiences, and they each qualified for that country, absolutely, we would choose the person that had more experience to go over the younger person.
But Mock says the Peace Corps doesn't have that choice as often as it would like. The Corps started a major recruiting drive for older Americans in 2007. It was aiming for 15% of its ranks to be at least 50 years old by 2009. Only 6% of its volunteers today are over 50. It's partnered with the AARP to get the word out that there's no age limit for volunteers. Mimi Castaldi heads the AARP's volunteer arm. She says countries are asking the Peace Corps for older volunteers.
They have the ability to look back at what they've learned during their working career and bring that to the Peace Corps. And so they bring a different level of maturity than a younger volunteer might. Countries are looking for life experiences that these volunteers can bring with them.
There are also cultural reasons countries want older volunteers. Elders are more respected in some cultures. Young Peace Corps volunteers have to work harder for that respect. The Peace Corps' Rosie Mock says Thailand is a case in point.
Their government has asked us to look for more older Americans. So absolutely, in some of our countries and in their cultures, it's seen as someone with much more respect, perhaps, given by everybody in the villages.
Garland Bollinger says there were 20 older volunteers in her group of 74. She says the older volunteers mixed well with the college kids, except for one thing.
Now, I will say that perhaps I don't stay up as late or party as hard at this point in my life as I did a number of years ago, but I think we all had very good relationships.
Rusty partying skills aside, many older volunteers are held back by other life experiences, like college tuition or a mortgage payment. Maybe they're waiting to retire. Those weren't issues for Garland Bollinger. She sold her house and car. She says one of her biggest problems was dealing with friends trying to talk her out of the Peace Corps.
I did have a number of people tell me that I was making a very crazy decision to just step out of my career and join the Peace Corps for 2 years. I think basically I just explained that I didn't share that belief.
Now Garland Bollinger is getting a PhD in public administration. She wants to become qualified to teach anywhere in the world and maybe go to work for the Peace Corps. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
If you're the Peace Corps type, it's a safe bet you're not obsessed with your looks. They're not generally what you'd call glamour assignments. Still, as we age, it's hard not to notice crow's feet, sagging chin lines. And that explains why, according to the AARP, we spend more than $1.5 billion a year on anti-aging skincare products. Here's Cash Peters.
You know, I thought aging was just a horrible fact of life. I'm growing older, I'm going to fall apart, soon, by the looks of it, and die. That's it. But no, apparently I have options. Shari Rowan is a health writer for the Los Angeles Times.
There are things we can do to slow down the process and really make a significant difference on how we age and how we feel in old age.
Yeah, but can they be done cheaply and easily? Here's the mathematical equation I'm working with. Expensive plus difficult equals I'm not doing it.
For some people, they need to go into the whole consumer shtick. They need the exercise tights and the latest gym clothing, and they need the fitness trainer. And if you can afford that, fine.
But I can't, so let's never mention it again. There has to be a simpler way. George Lamoureux is an herbalist specializing in longevity.
Most of us believe that a normal lifespan should be around 120 years.
And when you say most, you mean you.
See, here's what you have to do. You have to fool the body into not turning on those genes that are going to get you on the road to degeneration. You have to keep the body young, or at least you have to make it think that it's young.
Exactly. And the way you do that, George says, is by making it feel strong and vital inside, and by staying in shape. Not, as I thought, by buying all that stuff you see in commercials. Cosmetic surgery and anti-aging creams. In fact, I have it on good authority. Well, okay, I got it from the woman at the LA Times. But she says that a lot of the creams, the ones that magic away wrinkles, guess what? Don't even work.
I can tell you that a lot of the very expensive skin creams, the anti-aging formulas that you see in fancy department stores, are no better than anything you'd pay $15 for in a drugstore. And they sometimes cost 10 times more.
Wow, jeepers, what a scandal. So, okay, what if I want to look young and stay young, but I'm an uncompromising cheapskate? You know, I'm just saying. Where do I start?
Start drinking really good water.
That's it. Jason Andrew Robel is a raw food chef, and he thinks we've made this living longer thing way too complicated.
What I think is being required is a value system switch. By the way, I just met a 108-year-old doctor who looks like he's in his 60s. His tips, for instance, were get out and walk and do things physical, very basic. Eat a lot of blueberries, very basic. Do things that make you feel good, very basic things.
So basic that I've not even thought of them. Here's another.
Exercise.
Now, I've never liked the sound of this, but Sherry Rowan's adamant.
Exercise is the closest thing we have to the magic pill. But the scientific evidence shows more than any other product, diet, surgery, anything, that exercise will yield the most benefit.
Okay, but you can't stop there. You have to eat well, too. David Wolf is one of the top nutrition experts in the world.
I'd start people off with two things. Fresh vegetable juices, because you feel that right away, and superfood blended smoothies, because you can feel it right away. It cuts through all the numbness, all the resistance, and people get an experience.
Yeah, all right, but haven't we heard all this before? Switch to organic fruits and vegetables, blah, blah, blah. But we never do it. It's all too expensive. Have these gurus any idea how much organic produce costs? And what's the point of superfoods such as herbs, acai berries, and cacao keeping you alive longer if your grocery bill gives you a coronary?
The money issue is an important issue, and my goal is always to get the prices of natural foods down, 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 down. But it has to be a step-by-step process. So we get more demand, we bring that price down and make it more accessible.
Okay, fine. So, water, free. Exercise, free. Good nutrition. Still a little pricey, but probably worth it. And finally, the last tip for longevity comes from Jim Root, who runs the Glen Ivy Spa in San Diego. Age 54, looks about 12. He says, do yourself a favor, relax outdoors, go stare at something.
Even if it's to look out at the mountain or look at a plant. And then for
me, that won't get rid of my wrinkles.
But what it will do is it works from the inside out. It has more long-lasting and real impact than all the creams and surgeries in the world.
Are you listening, Joan Rivers? In Los Angeles, for the next 50 years at least, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by LendingTree.com, offering the new loan coach, giving personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process. Just one of the many tools at the all-new LendingTree.com. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. At the end of last week's show, we opened a window onto something in the virtual world that baffles me to this day. They're YouTube videos called hauls, that's H-A-U-L-S, where folks detail their shopping loot.
I just wanted to show you what I got at the mall today. Bought three belts because I really needed some belts.
Reaction to our story ranged from thumbs down, just another example of materialism overriding what is really important, to hey, it's just life documentation and a way to review products. Well, one of our listeners, Moni Hill, was inspired.
Hi, guys. I'm going to film a haul for you.
Oh, geez.
And let me show you a sample of what I buy. For taco nights on Fridays, I got these whole grain corn taco shells. And I thought, well, that's just...
Okay, it's a parody. But what intrigued us was what Hill told us later about the haul video experience. Her first thoughts upon viewing?
Is this how we define ourselves, by what we buy and what we consume, and how prevalent is the consumer culture?
But then it became a teachable moment for her and her young daughters.
You can learn a lot about someone by the things they buy. Maybe that does tell the inside story. I mean, I had a lot of fun poking at myself because I do claim to be this, you know, natural, back-to-the-earth kind of mom. But I'll shop at Sam's for broccoli. So that's going to be on my next haul.
You can see Moni Hill's entire haul video at marketplace.org. I'll be in Vegas during the Academy Awards this weekend. Probably drop a buck or two on my favorite to win Best Picture, The Hurt Locker. Strictly funny money, of course, but imagine if you could really get in on the movie action. Maybe, say, put a little scratch on how well a certain movie is going to do. Well, pretty soon you can. It's a new offering in the futures market called the Cantor Exchange. Richard Jacobs is the company's president. And Richard, is this a version of, you know, the Hollywood parlor game where everyone has a prediction of how a movie's going to do at the box office?
Well, it's certainly the case that everybody has an opinion on how a movie's going to do at the box office, and we're giving them a properly structured exchange where they can go in and buy and sell that one millionth of a box office receipt.
All right. Well, take us through exactly how a trade works. I know your futures look 6 months out. So assuming that trading starts in April, I looked at a few end-of-the-year releases. And let's say I want to bet good money on the new Tron movie, which is out in December. I am a child of the 80s, after all. How would I do that?
Well, we'll have an auction 6 months before the Tron movie comes out. That will establish the opening day price. And after that, it'll trade just like any other futures contract or stock contract, where buyers and sellers will show up at the market. The market will move up and down. Finally, when Tron is released into movies, we'll get the opening weekend results. Traders will adjust their positions. After that fourth weekend, we'll settle the contract to the value that was actually earned in the box office. And the way we do that is we take the total box office receipts, divide it by a million, and that's the final value of the contract.
Okay, so say I wanted to put $1,000 on Tron doing really well. How would I know how much a share is, for example?
Well, when you come to the Cantor Exchange website, you'll actually see the price at which other folks, and you're trading always against other folks, are willing to buy and sell the contract at. And let's say in the case of Tron, I'm not sure what the level would be for Tron right now, but let's call it a $100 million movie.
Okay.
That would make each contract worth $100. So if you were looking to invest $1,000, you'd have a choice of buying or selling up to as many as 10 contracts.
I see. So then your shares, the number of shares you get are based on a prediction of how well the box office is going to do.
Correct.
Got it. So you definitely want a movie with legs then, not just a big opening weekend.
Legs is a big part of the equation. If you think a movie is going to have legs, Avatar was an example of this, buying it and seeing those legs benefit the upside of your position is certainly one good strategy.
There are some movies that aren't going to make it onto your exchange.
They have to be wide-release movies, and beyond just being wide-release, they have to sort of meet the internal test we have to just be certain that that movie is going to come out and that we don't have a complicated situation.
Doesn't that prevent you from being able to bet on, say, a sleeper hit, an indie hit?
It does, and for example, Slumdog would have been a movie that we would not have listed. But again, we are very concerned about the integrity of the marketplace, and the sleepers make that challenging.
If you were up and running already, which of the Oscar movies, aside from Avatar, obviously, might have been the big movers?
That's an interesting question. So much of that depends on the timing of your trade. Even Avatar was a sleeper right up until and through the opening weekend. What really made that film work for the people who were buying it was the fact that it had the legs. So you could have bought some films, probably made more money than you did even on Avatar if your timing was right.
I wonder if that would have applied to movies, you know, like Blindside, which I think also lasted longer than folks expected, even Up in the Air.
Both of those movies did very well. Blindside was incredible. It opened on our exchange for something on the order of $40, and nobody saw, they were blinded by it, if you will. and I think that movie settled for $140, which as a percentage return is much higher than you received on Avatar. There are films that are the other way. The Jonas Brothers movie that came out earlier in 2009 was disappointing. And so futures trading and all trading is risky, and this is no different.
Boy, you really can put your money on just about anything, can't you?
We're focused on movies for now.
Richard Jacobs is president of the Cantor Exchange and is a member of the board of directors there as well. And we've been talking about the pending release of a new exchange where you can bet on how movies are going to do. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, if you really can put your money on anything, how about handicapping whether or not there will be a Consumer Financial Protection Agency? We began the hour hearing what some consumers think about it, and now the comedic elites have weighed in. Here with a clip from a Funny or Die video. Picture this. President Obama has a nightmare and is visited by several former presidents, Clinton, Carter, Ford, Reagan, or at least by the folks who played them on Saturday Night Live. In this excerpt, Bush 41 and 43 are talking to the current Oval Office resident.
When I put the Iraq War on my credit card, I never dreamed I'd be paying 28% in interest rates. It's astronomical.
Yeah? Well, if you'd listened to me, it would have raised taxes.
Yeah, and then I would have had one term.
Yeah, that second term of yours was a real victory lapper, wasn't it, Dubbers? Now listen, Borat.
It's Barack.
Sorry, but you got to listen to these fellas, Babar. What you got to understand... is that we got a regulatory issue here. We got to regulate that, and we're going to get more bubbles. Mm-hmm. Going to get bigger, larger, then pop, money goes to the weasels. Sometimes you got to do the right thing. You got to take those approval ratings there and screw them. Ratings? Screw. Right?
I'll take him to a nasty town.
Well, I know a thing or two about doing what's right and being unpopular.
Oh, great, if it isn't Mr. Let's Get the Party Started. What do you say we open up a bag of Malay's potato chips?
Yeah. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. We've got that entire video on our website. Next time, there's a generalized rage out there over banks, bailouts, and bonuses. But when it hits your wallet in the form of a new fee, stomping around and pouting aren't your only options.
And that kind of anger, you know, you really do need to vote with your feet when you feel like you're being taken advantage of.
We'll have a how-to on moving your money. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility on the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.